But in 1971, Alice Waters, a 60s political activist, opened a restaurant in Berkeley called Chez Panisse that prioritized slow cooking with local, market-fresh, organic products. Since then, Waters has been joined by other local East Bay residents, like the food writer Michael Pollan, in popularizing what has become known as the Berkeley food movement. Today, the ideas about fresh, high-quality local produce that Waters and Pollan developed have become so mainstream that Amazon acquired the organic grocery chain Whole Foods for $13 billion in 2017. Let's hope that over the next few years, Mitch and Frida Kapoor's ideas about doing tech differently will spread with the same fecundity. You'll remember what the Greek mathematician Archimedes wrote about his view from nowhere. "Give me somewhere to stand and I shall move the earth." In its commitment to building an alternative ecosystem to Silicon Valley, the Kapoor Center and its network of local partners are creating that somewhere to stand. Of course, neither Oakland nor the Kapoor Center is unique. The former AOL CEO Steve Case, for example, is bringing the idea of social investing to the rest of America through his Revolution Ventures Fund. And all over America, there are similarly innovative entrepreneurs working on a more socially responsible tech ecosystem than that of Silicon Valley. One particularly impressive young social entrepreneur Case introduced me to is Ross Baird, the founder of Village Capital in Washington, D.C., a fund that is also focused on investing in tech startups run by minorities and women. But Oakland, because of both its geography and its history, remains special. A century after Gertrude Stein's heartless remark about her hometown, things have changed in the city, on the other side of the San Francisco Bay. Now there is a there. You can find it in Uptown, a couple of blocks north of the old Paramount Theater. Chapter 9. Worker and Consumer Choice. The Strike. On a map, it isn't far from Silicon Valley to Hollywood. I am headed down to the studios of 20th Century Fox, one of Hollywood's big six movie companies. So it's just a 50-minute flight from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and then a short cab ride to the Century City location a few miles west of Beverly Hills, where the 20th Century Fox lot, originally developed by the Fox Film Corporation in 1916, from 300 acres of Los Angeles farmland, is situated. But geography can sometimes be deceptive. Measured in anything except miles, it's actually quite a distance from the technologists of Silicon Valley to the content makers of Hollywood. It's a relationship, observed the veteran technology writer Michael Malone in 2017, that's on the rocks, a victim of seemingly irreconcilable differences. Lingering issues, such as piracy, Malone explains, have generated mistrust between Hollywood and Silicon Valley. The biggest problem, however, is what Malone calls the unprecedented success of big tech compared with the economic struggles of the movie studios. "There's no way Hollywood can win under the current rules," Malone observes about a new digital distribution system monopolized by such companies as Amazon, Google, YouTube, and Apple. In this bleak conclusion, Malone might have also been describing the impact of Silicon Valley on other creative industries, particularly the recorded music business, whose global revenue has been cut in half over the last 25 years. As my taxi winds its way through the 20th Century Fox lot, we drive past movie sets designed as backdrops to the telling of Hollywood stories. There is even a set of what appears to be a cobbled street of 19th century industrial New York City, the sort of grimy urban backdrop where one could imagine striking garment or meatpacking workers confronting thugs hired by capitalist bosses. In Hollywood, 19th century neighborhoods really are full of 21st century things. I have come to Century City to meet with the movie producer, music promoter, and entrepreneur Jonathan Taplin, whom I've known since the mid-90s, when he founded Entertainer, the Internet's first video-on-demand service. We are sitting outside the Fox Commissary, the oldest staff canteen in Hollywood, which over the last 80 years has entertained such stars as Marilyn Monroe, Elizabeth Taylor, and Richard Burton. Originally called the Café de Paris, and doubling as a restaurant set, the commissary is an Art Deco building that still boasts a set of original 1935 murals featuring Shirley Temple and Will Rogers. In this theatrical setting, Taplin has some appropriately dramatic news for me about the creative industry's response to what is widely perceived as YouTube's exploitative business model. "You have to swear not to tell anyone," he confides. "It's a total secret. Nobody knows about this yet." "Absolutely, John," I reply, putting my hand on my heart jokingly. "I mean, who would I tell?" You'll remember that the Los Angeles-based Jonathan Taplin, the serial entertainment entrepreneur who produced Martin Scorsese's breakthrough 1973 classic Mean Streets and managed some of Bob Dylan's early tours, as well as George Harrison's Concert for Bangladesh, argues that the digital revolution has triggered a massive reallocation of $50 billion a year from the creative industry to winner-take-all internet companies such as YouTube and Facebook. Like Frida Kapor Klein, Taplin is a central figure in the growing opposition to Silicon Valley. Like the Oakland-based tech activist, he too is a veteran of the Vietnam War protests and civil rights struggles of the 60s and 70s. In contrast, however, with Kapor Klein's goal of building an alternative investment ecosystem to Silicon Valley, Taplin's focus is more directly political. His 2017 book, Move Fast and Break Things, borrows its title from Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg's notorious mantra to disrupt as much as possible without taking responsibility for any of the resulting damage. Taplin reserves his sharpest critique for Silicon Valley's libertarian ideology, with its fetishization of free market forces, which has enabled this new economy to so radically disrupt old business models and economic practices. And he has become a kind of informal labor organizer, encouraging the resistance of musicians and filmmakers to these controversial new models and practices. "It's an artist's strike," Taplin continues, lowering his voice conspiratorially. "We might as well be sitting on that 19th century New York City movie set in the 20th century Fox lot and plotting the industrial action of workers against their exploitative bosses." Taplin is talking about a full-scale strike of musicians opposed to the economics of YouTube, with its controversial business practice of paying artists only around a sixth of what other services like Apple and Spotify pay. The strike would be modeled on Taylor Swift's 2014 withdrawal of almost all her music from Spotify and her 2015 decision to pull her best-selling album, 1989, off Apple Music, because the new streaming service wasn't intending to pay artists in the first 3 months of its existence. Over the last couple of hundred years, labor strikes have been one of the most effective ways for employees to force reform of their working conditions and pay. If we go back to the New York City of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, for example, strikes often triggered deadly violence between workers and the authorities. In the summer of 1877, after New Yorkers came out in support of a national railway workers' strike, the authorities, fearing a proletarian revolution, called out the National Guard, who descended on the protesters with guns and clubs. In 1886, streetcar conductors, having walked out in support of a 12-hour workday and a dinner break, responded to police beatings by setting their streetcars on fire. Most notoriously, in 1909, in the largest work stoppage in U.S. history, ladies' garment workers from New York's Triangle Shirtwaist Company walked out for shorter hours, better pay, and safety. In response, private detectives organized scab labor, and owners hired prostitutes to start fights with striking workers. On 7th Street, workers packed into Cooper Union College roared in support as Clara Lemlich, a slight, dark-eyed girl who had endured 6 broken ribs from a beating, urged on the demonstrators. "This is not a strike," Lemlich cried. "This is an uprising." Taylor Swift is no Clara Lemlich, of course, either in her personal bravery or in her economic need. But in principle, Swift's withdrawal of her work from Spotify and Lemlich's withdrawal of her labor from the Triangle Shirtwaist Company aren't fundamentally different. In both situations, workers have arrived at the last resort, withdrawing their labor from the market in order to reform the system. In both cases, they are using one of our five tools to fix not only their future, but the future of generations of workers and artists, too. As I write this in June 2017, Taplin's full-scale artists strike, this mass withdrawal of their creative work from YouTube, Spotify, and other streaming services, has yet to occur. But the role of globally recognized creative artists, particularly musicians, has been very influential in raising public awareness about the injustices of the YouTube-dominated entertainment economy. In June 2016, a couple of months after I met with Taplin in Century City, 1,000 of the world's leading musical acts, including ABBA, Coldplay, Ed Sheeran, and Lady Gaga, wrote to the EU Commission's president, Jean-Claude Juncker, complaining that YouTube is unfairly siphoning value away from artists and songwriters. YouTube, concluded Trent Reznor, the founder of Nine Inch Nails, has been built on the backs of free, stolen content. That same month, 180 artists, including Taylor Swift, Paul McCartney, and Carole King, also signed a petition calling for the reform of the 1996 Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA, the U.S. law that gives major internet services like YouTube safe harbor from copyright infringement liability as long as they respond to takedown requests from rights holders. The safe harbor provision in the DMCA is at the heart of many of the disputes about the accountability of internet companies like Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram for the posting of offensive, fake, or stolen content. Inadvertently providing cover for these companies to avoid taking legal responsibility for their illegal content, the safe harbor provision essentially allows multi-billion dollar web publishers like Facebook or YouTube to avoid being considered publishers under the law. No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider, the controversial clause in the DMCA states. What Fast Company's Christopher Zara described as the most important law in tech has, he says, turned into a protector of privilege because the DMCA doesn't make websites legally accountable for illegal content posted on their sites by third parties. As a magnified version of the internet itself, the DMCA represents a tragic law of unintended consequences, explains internet historian John Naughton. Just as the prohibition of alcohol in the United States from 1920 to 1933 triggered a massive increase in organized crime, so the DMCA has led, Naughton says, to an astonishing rise in hate speech, harassment, bullying, revenge porn, fake news, and other abuses of digital technology. Yes, move fast and break things, the DMCA is saying. Yes, profit from all the content posted on your network, but no, don't worry about the consequences of this content, because you aren't accountable for any of it under the law. Principal, among those other abuses, Naughton describes are the posting and exchange of illegal, mostly pirated content. And so opposition to the DMCA has become a rallying cry for artists who, like Taplin, see the internet as enabling that massive reallocation of wealth from the creative community to Silicon Valley. The June 2016 artists petition, issued in Washington, D.C. publications like Politico, The Hill, and Roll Call, argued that the DMCA has allowed major tech companies to grow and generate huge profits by creating ease of use for consumers to carry almost every recorded song in history in their pocket via a smartphone, while songwriters and artists' earnings continue to diminish. Many other artists, including Katy Perry, Motley Crue co-founder Nikki Sixx, and Debbie Harry, the lead singer in the 70s new wave band Blondie, have been outspoken in their calls to reform the DMCA. The problem, Debbie Harry argues, is that the DMCA has a loophole, the impossible-to-enforce clause in the law that enables YouTube to run huge amounts of illegal content and not to pay artists properly. While Blondie videos on YouTube garner hundreds of millions of views, Harry argues, none of us in Blondie will receive a fair amount of royalties from these millions of plays. This kind of celebrity resistance to both the DMCA and YouTube might not have quite the same dramatic resonance as the progressive-era New York City street battles between striking garment workers and thugs hired by the factory owners. But it does represent a new kind of industrial action for the networked age. A mix of direct political action, coalition building, pressure on legislative and regulatory authorities, and the powerful threat of a collective boycott, if nothing else works. The boycott card is also being played by other coalitions opposed to Google's and YouTube's commercial dominance. The advertising industry is becoming increasingly exasperated with Google's and YouTube's automated plastering of online ads next to offensive content, such as videos promoting anti-Semitism or terrorist groups like ISIS and Al-Shabaab. This represents another example of these hugely powerful and wealthy companies refusing to be accountable for the content posted on their networks. The really troubling thing about this advertising problem is that Google and YouTube are, essentially, making money from overtly racist and violent videos and other disgustingly inappropriate content. In March 2017, a number of blue-chip firms, including the UK offices of McDonald's, L'Oreal, Volkswagen, Audi, Vodafone, Sky, HSBC, Lloyd's, and Royal Bank of Scotland, all suspended their advertising on Google and YouTube because their ads appeared next to videos featuring hate preachers and the former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke. The French advertising company Havas, the world's sixth largest marketing company, even went as far as to pull all its UK clients' advertising from Google in an attempt to get the Silicon Valley company to police the content on its platform more carefully. And a few days after these European boycotts made news, a number of major American advertisers, including Starbucks, AT&T, Walmart, Verizon, and Johnson & Johnson, joined the defection, announcing an end to their ad spending on Google until the system is made more accountable. These actions have the implicit support of Sir Martin Sorrell, the CEO of WPP, the world's largest marketing company, who remarked that Google and Facebook have the same responsibilities as any media companies and could not masquerade as mere technology platforms. Sorrell, with whom I've spoken at great length over the years about this problem of responsibility and accountability, is absolutely right. The fundamental problem about not just Google and YouTube, but also Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and many other Silicon Valley companies, is their unwillingness to grow up and assume the complex responsibilities of media companies. This means not only ensuring that the content on their networks isn't stolen or hateful, but also guaranteeing that advertisers don't find their messages attached to offensive or illegal content that tarnishes their brands. The work of all these industry coalitions, from angry music artists to untrusting advertisers and marketing companies, is critically important. Nothing will be reformed unless both political and commercial pressure is placed on the private superpowers to reform their behavior and business models. If enough pressure is exerted, things will change. If not, they won't. So, less than 24 hours after Taylor Swift's 2015 threat to boycott Apple Music, the company changed its policy and promised to pay artists for streaming, even during a customer's free trial period. The announcement even came with an apologetic personal tweet from Eddie Q, the head of Apple Music. "We hear you, at Taylor Swift 13 and indie artists. Love, Apple," Q wrote on Twitter the day after Swift threatened to boycott his service. And immediately after the March 2017 advertising boycott of YouTube, Google's chief business officer announced expanded safeguards to protect advertisers, including hiring significant numbers of people to enforce the notice and takedown process, as well as using AI to speed up the process of tagging offensive content. The boycott also resulted in Google's introducing what it called third-party brand safety features for its customers, enabling them to track their advertisements to see where they appear on YouTube. Then, in June 2017, Google's general counsel announced four more steps YouTube was taking to fight online terror, including more aggressively identifying and taking down flagrantly offensive videos, giving advertisers more control on where their ads appear, and hiding questionable content so that it can't be monetized or recommended. While some advertisers remained skeptical about these policy changes, what the boycott shows is that if enough pressure is applied, Google and YouTube will at least try to address the issue and make themselves more accountable. Yes, as Rob Norman, the chief digital officer of the WPP-owned Group M, one of the world's largest buyers of online media, acknowledges, the filtering of inappropriate content is a complex problem, equivalent to threading the needle. But Norman is hopeful that Google can fix this problem. They're one of the world's outstanding science companies, he says, and if anyone can do this, they can. Given that 6 out of 10 people now get their news from social media, Facebook has also been heavily criticized for its unwillingness to take responsibility for the content posted on its network. The distribution of fake news has been a particular concern, with Mark Zuckerberg even being forced by many critics to deny that Facebook was to blame for the election of Donald Trump. "No, we are a tech company, not a media company," Zuckerberg said immediately after the November 2016 American presidential election. And yet, for all Zuckerberg's denials of a self-evident truth, Facebook is, as I noted earlier, increasingly behaving like a quintessential media company in its aggressive attempts to fix the problem of fake news. In December 2016, it announced a partnership with independent fact-checkers to filter fake news from its feeds. In March 2017, it launched a third-party fact-checking tool that will alert users to disputed content, a feature that Google also introduced a couple of weeks later. Then, in April 2017, after criticism from German Chancellor Angela Merkel about the dangerous political ramifications of fake news, Facebook, which has 29 million German users, even took out full-page ads in Germany's biggest newspaper explaining how to combat this content. Boycotts, political pressure, public criticism, and even the threat of a strike do work, then, in forcing Silicon Valley companies to try to fix the most egregious consequences of their services. As Group M's Rob Norman notes, these aren't simple problems, and they don't have easy answers. But if anyone can solve the problems of fake news and the attachment of offensive content to advertising, it's Facebook and Google. Yet the only way this will happen is by challenging their bottom line. When threatened with a loss of revenue, these multi-billion dollar businesses will act and make themselves more accountable. Otherwise, they won't. The challenge, our challenge then, is to maintain the public conversation about these issues so that everyone, from advertisers to governments to consumers, is aware of how unaccountable the system is becoming. But this sometimes requires great tenacity, particularly when that conversation is only just beginning. It demands somebody crazy enough to single-handedly take on a multi-billion dollar industry. Sex, drugs, and Moore's Law. Offstage, rock and roll artists are usually anything but rebels, resisting powers larger than themselves. But David Lowery, the guitarist, songwriter, and vocalist, who founded the 90s rock band Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker, is unlike most rock and roll artists. Rather than just singing about revolution, he is actually perched on the ramparts and leading the rebellion against the new Ancien Régime. Lowery is a genuine rebel, a guy just crazy enough to personally take on a million-billion-dollar industry. As the New York Times explains, he has come to represent the anger of musicians in the digital age. It's an anger stoked by Jonathan Taplin's massive reallocation of wealth, which has resulted not only in the creation of unimaginable fortunes in Silicon Valley, but also in the worse-than halving of global recorded music sales over the last 15 years, from $14.6 billion in 1999 to $7.02 billion in 2015. Yes, business models and industries change, and nothing lasts forever, particularly in today's perpetual Schumpeterian storm of digital disruption. And yes, the success of streaming services like Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, and Rhapsody, which now make up 34.5% of overall sales, seems, over the last couple of years, to have finally halted the death spiral of the recorded music economy. Between 2015 and 2016, for example, overall music streaming increased in the United States by 68%, with revenues on subscription services rising 114% to $2.5 billion. But this new business model of streaming all-you-can-eat content in exchange for a monthly subscription fee, while great for consumers and the labels, has turned out to be anything but an ideal solution for creative artists. The problem, as Debbie Harry, Katy Perry, and Lady Gaga all remind us, is that many of the streaming services, particularly YouTube and Pandora, pay such miserly royalty rates. So as the New York Times notes about the streaming market, the music industry finds itself fighting over pennies while waving goodbye to the dollars. Things have become so skewed that the niche market in high-margin vinyl records is creating more revenue for the music industry than all those billions of views on YouTube. In the shift to streaming, the Times concludes, the music business has lost billions. As David Lowery put it in a typically acerbic blog post, "My song got played on Pandora 1 million times, and all I got was $16.89, less than what I make from a single T-shirt sale." And so Lowery, who also teaches music economics at the University of Georgia, has become the public face of the angry musician. Having launched his second career as an outspoken critic of large internet companies, in what Billboard describes as his now-famous "meet the new boss, worse than the old boss" speech, at the 2012 San Francisco Music Tech Summit, Lowery has fought an unrelenting one-man war against everything, from the exploitative business models of Pandora and YouTube to the immorality of online music theft. He is, according to Bloomberg, one cranky rocker who is taking on the entire streaming music business. Like Taplin's, David Lowery's goal is to raise consciousness about the injustice of a new economic system in which musicians and songwriters are being so callously exploited. But Lowery is more than just a gadfly buzzing angrily around the new digital establishment. In late 2015, he launched a $150 million class action copyright infringement lawsuit on behalf of other songwriters against Spotify, the $8 billion Swedish-based streaming service. The suit, based on Lowery's own painstaking research, asserted that Spotify hadn't acquired the mechanical licenses for much of the musical content it was streaming. Spotify, in Lowery's words, was a copyright infringement machine that was essentially stealing the work of songwriters like himself. A couple of months later, he filed a similar suit against Rhapsody, requesting that it too pay all songwriters and artists for the use of their work. As with the advertising industry's boycott of Google, Lowery was making these streaming companies responsible for their actions. He was forcing accountability on an industry that was breaking all the rules. While these suits remain ongoing, Lowery's ferocious bellicosity has inspired young artists to believe that they too can change the system. According to the prominent music lawyer Chris Castle, Lowery has changed the conversation by showing that the only way, at least in America, to alter the system is through the courts. Legislation, the Austin, Texas-based Castle told me, is no longer the solution. The only people who can impose copyrights are the creators themselves. There is no guardian angel, no Margrethe Vestager in Washington, D.C., Castle suggests, who will do it for them. Dennis Cooker, the president of global digital business at Sony Music, agrees with Castle. "Lowery has made it safe for artists to jump in," Cooker told me when I visited him at his office in Midtown Manhattan. "Artists particularly need to speak out about the broken DMCA safe harbor law," Cooker insists, although he expects the major legislative push on this to come from Europe. In spite of the paid subscription growth through Apple Music and Spotify, it's been a brutal decade for the music industry, Cooker acknowledges, particularly for artists. And the only way that's going to change, he says, is through the political commitment of artists like David Lowery. After leaving Cooker at Sony's glitzy office, I take the train to Philadelphia to meet Lowery. I'm headed for a small live music venue a few blocks from the downtown Philadelphia railway station. Its dirty windows are plastered with homemade agitprop signs, suggesting an ongoing war with digital music. Rhythms rather than algorithms. Community, not commodity. Curated, not encoded, these signs declare. In Philly, I'm catching Lowery on tour, between gigs in Pittsburgh and Cleveland. I buy him dinner at a noisy ribs restaurant next to the venue. He is doing two sets that evening for a private corporate party. He tells me that he normally does 100 live shows a year and makes around $100,000 annually from his music. $50,000 from the road and $50,000 from royalties, mostly, presumably, from his one and only big hit, the 1993 Cracker song, Low, which sold 1 million copies. So much, then, for the glamour and the wealth of the rock and roll life. The business is getting out on the road, playing shows in as many markets as you can, getting bloggers to write about you, he tells me. What's been lost is the middle class. What is so extraordinary about Lowery is the ordinariness of his American manners and appearance. He is reassuringly reasonable in his unreasonableness. If Hollywood ever made a movie about his exploits and Jimmy Stewart were still around, he'd be perfect to play the role of this aw shucks everyman rebel. I ask him about his anger. What drives him to single-handedly take on multi-billion dollar companies like Spotify and Pandora? Why invest so much time in trying to save the future of recorded music? My grandma said, red hair marks the crazy ones, the now mostly gray-haired Lowery confesses. It must be the Irish or Scots in me. Crazy, perhaps, but also smart. In 2006, Lowery, a math quant as well as a minor rock and roll star, was at a party in Chicago where he met a guy called Brad Keywell, who was carrying around Nassim Nicholas Taleb's The Black Swan, the best-selling book about the highly improbable. They got into conversation, and with a black swan-like improbability, Lowery ended up consulting for Keywell's startup, a special deals e-commerce website that later became known as Groupon. Paid in stock for his work, Lowery made $1 million after the Groupon public offering in 2011, which at the time was the biggest internet IPO since Google's in 2004. When it went public, it was worth $21 billion. Lowery says, putting down a half-eaten spare rib and raising an arm in the air to indicate the absurdly stratospheric valuation of the 2011 Groupon IPO. That was totally fucking insane. In Silicon Valley parlance, fuck you money means having so many hundreds of millions of dollars, a la Peter Thiel, that you can do or say anything you like, even publicly support Donald Trump. But all David Lowery needed was $100,000 to buy him his freedom. You see, out of that $1 million he made from the Groupon IPO, he set aside 10% as a kind of personal tithe to do good. And it's this money that has not only enabled him to fight Spotify and Rhapsody in the courts, but also to reinvent himself as the cranky rocker able to take on the entire streaming business. The building is on fire, Lowery says, smiling sadly, referring to the shift to a streaming business model in which consumers get access to all the music ever recorded for under $10 a month. My job is to turn the tables. But whether it's building coalitions of artists or fighting tech companies in court or just raising hell on the internet, there is no magic bullet, no single solution to fix the future of the music business, Lowery acknowledges. On the one hand, he says, the current subscription services aren't sufficiently rewarding artists. On the other, he remains hopeful that YouTube will eventually shift much of its content from free access to a subscription model. So subscription is both the problem and the answer. It all depends on who gets paid what. There is one thing, however, about which Lowery is certain. The existential crisis of the system, he insists, is coming. Ironically, it will be spurred on, he hopes, by ad blocking. Once everyone on a mass scale starts blocking ads with disruptive services like Tim Schumacher's AdBlock Plus, then all the companies with advertising-based business models, particularly YouTube, will be forced into offering subscription-based services to their users. So in the end, the market and consumer demand will drive a shift back to a paid model. And then the challenge will be to ensure that artists are paid more than the price of a t-shirt each time a million people listen to one of their songs. If Lowry is right about the eventual demise of advertising-based models, then we are going to need innovative new internet businesses like Peter Sunde's micro-donation network Flatter, which enables more personalized commercial relationships between artists and consumers. Flatter, like the American creative platform Patreon and the Dutch micro-payments news network Blendl, the so-called iTunes for news, goes beyond the centralized business model of networks like Spotify and Netflix by enabling artists and journalists to create direct commercial relationships with their consumers. These are all examples of Brad Burnham's decentralized marketplaces, in what he and Tim Berners-Lee call the re-decentralization of the web. You get the economy you pay for, Lowry tells me. What he is noticing, however, is that a younger generation of music lovers is recognizing the importance of paying for content. My students get it, he tells me, smiling for the first time. They understand that nothing is free. The New York Times technology columnist Farhad Manju shares Lowry's tentative optimism about the beginnings of a rebirth of paid online content. Things are turning around for people of the future. Our time may be remembered as a period not of death, but of rejuvenation and rebirth, Manju argues. Speaking of a decentralized subscription platform like Patreon that, in 2016, enabled 35 artists to make more than $150,000 apiece. The internet, Manju suggests, might actually be saving rather than killing culture. I don't have to go out on the road and play in bars, one a cappella singer making $20,000 a month on Patreon tells Manju. I can be a father and I can be a husband. This normalizes my career. It normalizes the career of being an artist, which has never been normalized. If Manju is correct about this cultural renaissance, some of the credit for it should go to David Lowry, who perhaps more than any other working musician has directly taken on big tech for the right of artists to be fairly compensated for their work. Lowry is forcing accountability on the nascent streaming economy. He is making it grow up. The lawyer strikes back. The morning after David Lowry's gig in Philadelphia, I take the train up to Boston. From my hotel near the station, I order an Uber to transport me to the offices of Licton and Liss Reardon, a law firm based in Boylston Street, the major commercial thoroughfare running through the New England city. The car comes almost instantly, its electronic image zipping along the Boston streets on my iPhone app to alert me to its arrival. For frequent travelers, ride-sharing networks such as Uber and Lyft offer an incredibly convenient and cheap way to get around cities at home and abroad, like free YouTube videos or the absurdly cheap Spotify subscription service. They seem almost too good to be true, which is exactly what many of these new digital products actually are, at least from the perspective of the workers, the creative artists or drivers whose labor provides their core value. What it means to be a worker has changed dramatically over the last century. In the industrial age, there was the proletariat, the armies of permanent wage laborers who worked in the factories. Today, however, in a network age of increasing inequality between rich and poor, there is the precariat, a growing class of impermanently employed folks who scrape out a living renting out their spare rooms via Airbnb, delivering groceries on Instacart, or driving their cars for one of the new ride-sharing companies. The operating system for labor in a networked economy, where 40% of all American workers are predicted to become members of the precariat by 2020, is changing with dizzying rapidity. But what, unfortunately, isn't changing with anything like the same speed is the way in which the law is applied to protect these badly paid, precariously employed workers from rapacious private superpowers like Uber. These companies, warned an April 2017 New York Times editorial about gig economy startups, have discovered that they can harness advances in software and behavioral sciences to old-fashioned worker exploitation, because employees lack the basic protection of American law. My Uber driver, a polite young man from Pakistan in a spotlessly clean white Toyota Prius, tells me that he's working part-time to help pay his tuition costs as an engineering graduate student at Boston University. I ask him whether he's happy working for the $70 billion ride-sharing startup founded by Travis Kalanick, who in February 2017 was filmed swearing angrily at a destitute Uber driver for not being sufficiently self-reliant. The driver's answer to my question is ambivalent. Yes, he confirms, he enjoys the freedom of choosing his own hours, but the income, he says, isn't as much as he'd hoped it would be, particularly after he subtracted the insurance, gas, depreciation, and the other costs of running his Prius. In fact, he admits on slow days, he suspects that he ends up with less than the $11 an hour Massachusetts minimum wage. So, Uber doesn't provide any benefits at all? I ask. No, nothing. I'm an independent contractor, he tells me a little sadly. I work for myself. A pioneer of the so-called sharing or gig economy, Uber, borrowing from the Silicon Valley libertarian fantasy of absolute personal freedom, describes itself as a company that empowers people to work when and where they want, without having the restrictive commitments of a regular full-time job. Although this may be true in some ways, it doesn't in practice feel very empowering to most of the now more than 1.5 million Uber drivers in 70 countries around the world. The problem is that the gig economy's absence of commitment works both ways. Yes, the drivers don't have to commit all their time to Uber, but then Uber isn't committing anything to the drivers either. This is emblematic of an increasingly unequal economy where, in truth, multi-billion dollar startups like Uber and Lyft share none of their stratospheric value with their workers. Indeed, a July 2017 report about the gig economy by the British MP Frank Field alleges that some self-employed UK drivers are earning only £2.50 an hour working for sharing economy companies like Parcelforce and WeBuyAnyCar.com. In reality, there is no utopia at companies like Uber, Lyft, Instacart, and Handy, whose workers are often manipulated into working long hours for low wages while continually chasing the next ride or task, that 2017 New York Times editorial argues. Or, as the New Yorker staff writer Gia Tolentino bluntly put it, commenting on the cult of work celebrated by on-demand companies such as the freelance marketplace Fiverr, the gig economy celebrates working yourself to death. My own experience as a heavy Uber user chimes with these conclusions. On my travels around the world to research this book, I've discussed the value of Uber with many of my drivers. Very few had anything good to say about the Silicon Valley startup, and most admitted that they were looking for alternative ways to make extra money. There was, for example, the Singaporean retiree, a former marketing executive at Singapore Airlines, who had been pushed into driving an Uber vehicle because his son wanted him out of the house. He worked 60 hours a week and made 500 Singapore dollars, around $350, less than a cleaner, he told me, disgustedly, about his less than $6 an hour rate. All this is anecdotal, of course, an old-fashioned method of research conducted from the back of a very new kind of taxi. But these conclusions are also confirmed by the data. One Uber drivers group in New York City estimates that a fifth of its members earn under $30,000 before expenses like gas, maintenance, and insurance. And a 2017 report undertaken by the online technology resource, The Information, found that only 4% of drivers remain on the Uber platform a year after they begin working for the rideshare company. The problem, as I've suggested, is the law. or more precisely, the failure of the pre-existing law to be applied to the new gig economy. And that's exactly why I'm visiting the law offices of Licton and Liss Reardon in Boston. When we arrive on Boylston Street, I thank my driver and award him a 5-star rating on my iPhone. I wish I could have tipped him too, but the app doesn't allow me to do that, presumably because the tip would go straight to the driver rather than to Uber. There were, of course, no gig economy companies in Thomas More's utopia, nor were there any lawyers. The self-deprecatingly witty Moore, who himself practiced law in 16th century London, banned them from his island. In Utopia, everyone is a legal expert, he tells us about an imaginary society in which law had been radically democratized. For the laws are very few, and they consider the most obvious interpretation of any law to be the fairest. In the real world, however, especially in the United States, there is no shortage of either professional lawyers or complicated laws for them to interpret. Still, given the country's increasingly dysfunctional political system, this might not be such a bad thing. Historically, crusading lawyers like Ralph Nader have played an important role in reforming American capitalism. As the music attorney Chris Castle told me, citing the example of David Lowery's class action lawsuits against Spotify and Rhapsody, the law may today be our most effective avenue for making entertainment companies accountable. You'll also recall the central role of the Silicon Valley attorney Gary Reback in the U.S. government's antitrust trial against Microsoft in the 1990s, a case that eventually enabled the innovation-rich Web 2.0 revolution of Google and Facebook. I've come to Boston to meet a lawyer dubbed by one plaintiff, Sledgehammer Shannon, who is, according to Mother Jones, Uber's worst nightmare. Shannon Liss Reardon is the Harvard-trained lawyer who, over the last 5 years, has led the legal fight against the gig economy's treatment of its workers. Politico included her in its 2016 list of America's 50 most influential people, and San Francisco Magazine described her as the most reviled woman in Silicon Valley, who has achieved a kind of celebrity unseen in the legal world since Ralph Nader sued General Motors. In person, the diminutive Liss Reardon resembles anything but a sledgehammer. As the labor lawyer leads me into her office, which is peppered with political memorabilia from her fellow gig economy critic and political ally, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, she acknowledges that the digital revolution has made people work more efficiently. I love what technology can do for us, she tells me, sounding a lot like Margrethe Vestager. But it shouldn't be abused. The comparison of Shannon Liss Reardon with Ralph Nader is also useful. You'll remember that it was Nader's best-selling 1965 book, exposing the fatal flaws in the Chevrolet Corvair, unsafe at any speed, the designed in dangers of the American automobile, that ultimately undermined the global domination of the U.S. car industry. 50 years later, Liss Reardon has uncovered the designed-in danger of America's latest automotive innovation, the online drive-sharing industry. But whereas Nader identified the flawed mechanics of American cars, Liss Reardon's crusade has focused on the flawed employment architecture of the American gig economy. In 2013, Liss Reardon filed a class action suit on behalf of California Uber drivers. It claimed that Uber has misclassified its drivers as independent contractors, when in fact they are official employees and thus have the legal right to benefits like workers' compensation, unemployment, and Social Security. The suit also claimed that Uber fixed the price of rides by promising that tips were included, and then failed to pass on the extra money to the drivers. In 2015, Liss Reardon compromised with Uber, negotiating a settlement of $84 million on behalf of 325,000 drivers in California and 60,000 in Massachusetts, which allowed the Silicon Valley company to continue employing its drivers as independent contractors. She has also pursued similar class action cases against Lyft, the food delivery companies DoorDash and Grubhub, the grocery app Instacart, and the shipping app Ship. In July 2015, the home cleaning gig startup HomeJoy, a high-profile company that Forbes described as a Silicon Valley darling, shut down its CEO claiming that a Liss-Reardon worker classification lawsuit was the deciding factor in making the choice to close the company. Like David Lowry, all Liss-Reardon wants is accountability from these new companies. "I'm a surrogate regulator," she says, explaining that her job is really just helping to enforce the law. The old rules still apply. The nature of work hasn't changed. People still need legal protection from employers. Liss-Reardon's primary achievements is forcing the gig economy to grow up. Her lawsuits against Instacart and Shipp, for example, resulted in these two companies changing their employment policies and converting their contractors to full-time employees. Citing a 2015 National Employment Law Project, NELP, report, she tells me that there are now more and more on-demand economy companies that respect workers' rights, including the food delivery services Sprig and Munchery, the personal assistant company Hello Alfred, the valet parking service Lux, and the cleaning service MyClean. It's not only Liss-Reardon who is fixing this problem. Many other entrepreneurs, regulators, consumers, educators, and workers are also working to build an on-demand economy that is simultaneously innovative and fair. You'll remember that 4 out of 10 Americans are predicted to become part of the precariat by 2020, a prediction covering every industry from entertainment and media to transportation, education, legal, and healthcare. So this is one of the great issues of our time. If we get it right, we can guarantee a decent quality of work for future generations. It's easy, of course, to vilify a pantomime figure like the former Uber CEO, Travis Kalanick, the libertarian multi-billionaire who used to sport an image of Ayn Rand on his Twitter profile. Fortunately, however, there are some entrepreneurs with a much more adult sense of responsibility and accountability. Take, for example, Glenn Kelman, the CEO of the Seattle-based internet company Redfin, which provides a web-based real estate database, employs more than 1,000 agents, and conducted a highly successful IPO in July 2017. When Kelman founded Redfin in 2006, having sold his previous internet startup for $200 million, he insisted that the new startup employ real estate agents as full-time employees, with health benefits and 401k retirement contributions, rather than independent contractors. Glenn Kelman's rationale for this, in addition to sharing the wealth created by Redfin with everyone who worked for the company, was to provide better customer service. As a pioneer of this alternative model for startups, Kelman has even become what the New York Times calls an informal counselor for other startup entrepreneurs also interested in shifting away from the independent contractor employment model, because the shift makes both ethical and moral sense. As the subtitle of that NELP on-demand economy report said, "Why treating workers as employees is good for business." Some economists believe that we need to move away from the binary option of either the full-time employment model or the independent contractor model. Alan Krueger, the former chairman of President Barack Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, who now teaches economics at Princeton, believes that we are at a point today similar to that in the late 19th century with the emergence of an industrial workers' compensation system. But today, Krueger argued in a 2015 white paper, we need a new category of worker, neither completely freelance nor full-time. The Princeton economist defines this new hybrid category as an independent worker, arguing that gig economy workers at Uber or Lyft should qualify for some of the employment benefits of the old system, except for the ones that don't make sense. Although Krueger's proposal sounds eminently reasonable, it is unlikely to be implemented in an increasingly hostile political environment that pits government regulators and the courts against tech disruptors like Uber or Airbnb. As with antitrust, we ultimately need regulatory protection from some of the most egregious consequences of the on-demand market. And governments all over the world are working to shape a peer-to-peer economy that will protect both workers and consumers. In 2015, for example, the Seattle City Council voted unanimously to approve a bill that allows drivers for ride-hailing apps to form unions. In 2016, a London employment tribunal ruled that these drivers are indeed entitled to workers' rights, including the national minimum wage and paid holidays. In 2016, Uber paid $25 million to settle a lawsuit filed by the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco, claiming that the rideshare company misled customers with a false sense of security about its checks on drivers. In Austin, Texas, voters rejected Uber's and Lyft's proposal to self-regulate their services. "Trust us," this 2016 local referendum asked. "No," the voters replied. Politicians around the world are also working to responsibly regulate other areas of the sharing economy. Shannon Liss Reardon's political ally, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, has taken on Airbnb, claiming that the $31 billion valued home-sharing startup is forcing up rents in large cities. In October 2016, Warren established a coalition of lawmakers from more than a dozen cities, urging the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, to help cities protect consumers and to study how the short-term rental market is affecting the overall rental market. In November 2016, regulators in New York City and San Francisco successfully got Airbnb to establish a one-host, one-home rule for new hosts as a defense against rising rents. In an attempt to protect affordable housing, both Berlin and Barcelona have clamped down on Airbnb, with Berlin banning the renting of apartments to tourists and Barcelona aggressively cracking down on illegal rentals. Even Iceland, in order to control the prices of the local market, has passed a law restricting the number of days that properties can be rented out on Airbnb. The precariat itself is also taking to the streets in order to change the system. In August 2016, drivers of Uber Eats, Uber's food delivery service, picketed London restaurants to demand that Uber pay them the London living hourly wage of a guaranteed £9.40. $12.10. And in November 2016, there was a national protest in the United States by Uber drivers demanding a $15 minimum wage. In May 2016, meanwhile, the 35,000 Uber drivers in New York agreed to form an organization called the Independent Drivers Guild, which would be affiliated with more traditional industrial labor unions. Indeed, one of the first actions of this guild was an April 2017 petition signed by 11,000 drivers requiring Uber to include a tipping option in its app. And so, I recently became able to electronically tip good Uber drivers, like that polite young man from Pakistan who transported me to Shannon Liss Reardon's office in downtown Boston. Consumers are also using their collective muscle to force Uber to become more responsible and accountable. In early 2017, after the then Uber CEO Travis Kalanick was appointed to Donald Trump's Economic Advisory Council, a hashtag delete Uber protest organized on Twitter resulted in more than 200,000 Uber customers, around 0.5% of its 40 million users, closing their accounts. "Try Lyft, use a taxi, a bus or a train," advised the New York Times' Farhad Manju about kicking the Uber habit in the face of the company's never-ending toxicity. "Heck, hire a limo and a chauffeur with a golden top hat." Even Uber staffers joined in the protest, arguing in an internally circulated letter to Travis that his support for Trump was coloring the ride-sharing company as anti-immigrant. The protest was so effective that in January 2017, Kalanick bowed to popular pressure and quit Trump's advisory council. While all this labor activity is very encouraging, there is one problem. A flaw as potentially fatal as the mechanical defect that made the Corvair motor car such a death trap. It all assumes that human labor, drivers, valet parkers, cleaners, and grocery shoppers, remains at the core of the 21st century peer-to-peer economy. But this may be wrong. Imagine if robots replaced all this labor. Imagine if human labor itself is about to be made redundant by one of the most disruptive technological revolutions in history. This isn't some science fictional nightmare that Hollywood might flip into a dystopian movie. In January 2015, Uber gutted the robotics lab of Carnegie Mellon University to poach the 50 people who were working on self-driving cars. As I write this, a little over 2 years later, Uber is already conducting trials